everyone. I'm Sam.
And I'm Sean.
And this is Key to the Case. Welcome back. Thank you all for joining us for this case. I have quite a mysterious disappearance to share with you all this week. So let's get right into it. Cheryl Pearson was 37 years old at the time of her disappearance in 2002. Cheryl was raised by her parents, two longtime educators, Hazel and Leon, in a blue-collar neighborhood in Jackson, Tennessee. Cheryl was the youngest of Hazel and Leon's three children, with one sister and one brother. She was only 1 year younger than her sisters, so sometimes Hazel would dress them in matching outfits as if they were twins, but as you can imagine, that stopped once they got a bit older. Leon shared the cutest childhood story about Cheryl in an interview with the Commercial Appeal. He said Cheryl loved The Footbook by Dr. Seuss growing up and would insist that he read it to her repeatedly. And sometimes he'd try to sneak past a couple of pages, but Cheryl was always quick to catch him, demanding he go back and read them to her. Growing up, and as you'll see into adulthood, Cheryl really enjoyed school and learning. Her constant studying got her out of a lot of household chores. After Cheryl graduated from high school in 1982, she attended the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, earning a bachelor's degree in chemical engineering. She worked in the field for a few years in Delaware before pursuing her passion for medicine and being accepted into medical school. Cheryl was ecstatic when she was accepted by Meharry Medical College, a historically Black college in Nashville. Cheryl had type 1 diabetes, and so she was insulin dependent. She wore an insulin pump that delivered subcutaneous doses. And this presented challenges for her growing up and was likely a factor in her chosen specialty of pediatrics. I'm not sure where she completed her residency, but it's reported that she had internships in Chicago, Nashville, and Detroit. So possibly one of those places or somewhere else. Cheryl applied for her medical license in her home state of Tennessee and moved to the Memphis area about 70 miles east of Jackson, where she grew up in the late 1990s and began her career as a pediatrician. At the time of her disappearance, to my knowledge, she was working as an outpatient pediatrician at the Raleigh Group, which is also sometimes referred to as Raleigh Group Pediatrics in Memphis. Cheryl was a skilled pediatrician known for her ability to make her oftentimes anxious patients feel at ease. Her personal experience as a juvenile diabetic, coupled with her love for children, helped Cheryl connect with her patients. She was well-liked by her colleagues, often spending time with them outside of work, and they described her as a kind-hearted and generous person. No one could imagine Cheryl, of all people, could have an enemy. Cheryl was family-oriented, too. So outside of work, she spent much of her time with her family and friends. She was the outgoing, life-of-the-party type, always ready to play a board game at a moment's notice. She loved games, apparently, and especially games that had an aspect of mystery to them and could also be found working on a jigsaw puzzle in her free time.
Sounds like you're describing yourself.
Yes, I do love jigsaw puzzles. But I don't do them enough. I haven't done one this year yet, but I should. And I also love games, and obviously games with an aspect of mystery. So yeah, I definitely noticed that when I was researching. She would also glue her puzzles sometimes that she would complete and then hang them up in her house. I think I read that she had this puzzle of dolphins that she had hung up in her house when she disappeared. Before her disappearance, Cheryl lived in a nice brick home in Bartlett, Tennessee, a suburb of Memphis. Cheryl was a season ticket holder of the Memphis NBA team, the Grizzlies. And so on Friday, January 4th, 2002, Cheryl attended one of their games against the Atlanta Hawks at the Pyramid Arena in Memphis. The Grizzlies no longer play at this location, but in 2002, that's where they played their home games. Cheryl went by herself to the game, something she had done before. And she called her mom during halftime and they spoke for just a few minutes. She called to ask her mom how her hero, Michael Jordan, was playing in a televised game. Jordan had retired and then came back out of retirement and was playing for the Washington Wizards, who were playing his former team, the Chicago Bulls, that night. And they ended up winning the game. But Hazel said in an interview with the Commercial Appeal about Cheryl's question, quote, "I think she already knew, but she was meddling with me. I had always said that Michael was too old to play and she loved Michael," end quote. So Cheryl was more or less just calling to razz her mom about Michael Jordan.
I feel like this is our soft launch into switching genres to a sports podcast.
Just a quick little sports history moment there for you. But Cheryl spoke with her mom most nights on the phone. So it was typical for Hazel to hear from her. And it made sense that Cheryl called her from the game. Now, early reports state that Cheryl mentioned she felt weak and lightheaded, but then it's not really mentioned again, which I suspect is because she did end up seeing friends later that night, which we'll get to, and they didn't say anything about her feeling or seeming unwell. And otherwise, Hazel said Cheryl seemed to be in good spirits. Normally, I'd say it's important to consider if someone is feeling unwell right before they disappear, but considering she felt well enough to see her friends and they didn't say anything about this, it was likely a fleeting feeling, one she presumably knew how to handle if related to her diabetes.
Did she have any other health concerns aside from the diabetes?
Not that I know of, no. The Grizzlies were narrowly defeated that night, and Cheryl went home after the game around 10:30 p.m. She had two of her girlfriends over that night and they stayed for a couple of hours, leaving her home between midnight and 1 a.m.
Did her friends notice anything unusual about Cheryl?
No, they said Cheryl seemed like her normal self. They said she wasn't expecting to see anyone that night, which I think is really important because of what happens next. But Cheryl indicated that her sister, Lorinda, would be coming by the next morning to drop her kids off. Her sister had two daughters and one son who Cheryl watched frequently. Lorinda was a physical therapist who had to work weekends sometimes. So Cheryl stepped up to watch the kids and it was something she really enjoyed. Cheryl loved spending time with her nieces and nephew. So she was excited to see them.
So I have a couple questions and I'm assuming you would have provided this information if it was true. Was Cheryl seeing anyone or married or did she have any kids?
She was not married. She didn't have kids. I saw one mention of a boyfriend and I didn't bring it up yet. I was going to bring it up later. Didn't bring it up yet because there's just not a lot of detail on it, but saw one mention that she had a boyfriend and he was ultimately looked into in this case, but I know nothing about him. So couldn't tell you how long they had been together or what their relationship was like.
Okay. Yeah. And my second question, did her sister and her kids, they live pretty close to Cheryl? You know, was it easy for them to make plans for Cheryl to watch the kids?
Yes, definitely. This was not a big trek for Lorinda to drive out to drop her kids off at Cheryl's house. I don't know if they lived in Bartlett, but they definitely lived in the Memphis area. When Lorinda arrived at Cheryl's house the next day, January 5th, around 7 a.m. with the kids, Cheryl was not home. Lorinda's knocks on Cheryl's door went unanswered, as well as her phone calls. This was highly unusual. Cheryl was known for being reliable, and Lorinda told the Commercial Appeal in an interview in 2003 that Cheryl would not leave knowing that Lorinda needed to get to work and she was responsible for taking care of the kids that day. It would be completely unlike her to do that without letting anyone know. Not knowing what to do, Lorinda called their parents, Hazel and Leon, to let them know about the situation. They jumped in their car and headed to Cheryl's to meet Lorinda as quickly as they could. At some point, shortly after they realized Cheryl was not answering her door, her parents and sister got inside the home. I don't know if they entered with a key they had. through the garage, possibly if they knew the code, or an unlocked door. But it sounded like her house was locked. And once they got in, they confirmed that Cheryl was not answering the door because she was not inside. Moments later, they went to the Bartlett Police Department to report Cheryl as a missing person. Cheryl's family feared that because of her diabetes, she could have fallen ill while away from home or driven off the side of the road since her car wasn't home. And she could be out there somewhere needing immediate medical attention. They share that they were not met with an immediate sense of urgency from the police, which I presume is because it hadn't been that long since Cheryl was last seen. It had probably been fewer than 10 hours since she was last seen by the time they reported her missing. But that's how serious this was to her family. It was the combination of two concerns that alarmed them. Cheryl's reliability. Why wasn't she at her house when she agreed to watch Lorinda's kids? And the fact that she had diabetes. That added an extra layer of worry. Despite a lack of immediate urgency, it seemed that changed pretty quickly because the police went to Cheryl's house and searches were underway within a day or so.
Do we know what the state of the house was like? You know, was it messy or did it seem like someone else may have been there besides Cheryl?
Her home looked pretty ordinary, kind of looked how it always did to them. And Cheryl's family did clean her house and make her bed while they waited around on Saturday, hoping she would show up, not thinking they were potentially cleaning up a crime scene. I mean, it didn't look like a crime scene. The police found no signs of a struggle, no evidence of forced entry. And I was curious about the bed. Since her family made it, I was wondering if she was the type to make her bed every day or not, because if she were the type to make her bed every day, then the bed being unmade should have given us some more insight into the timeline, meaning that after her friends left, she went to bed and something happened after that, or something got her to get out of bed. Or if she didn't typically make her bed, then it doesn't really tell us one way or the other, because something could have happened before she had the chance to go to bed, or she could have gotten to bed and something happened after. We just don't know. Although Cheryl's home looked ordinary, as I said, there were some items left behind at her home that made it appear as though she either left abruptly or unwillingly. Her cell phone and pager for work were sitting on a table. The cell phone at the house was odd, but the pager was probably even stranger because Cheryl was on call that weekend. So leaving her pager and cell phone behind, she'd be completely unreachable. And I have to give a shout out to our friend Natalie. She's a listener of the podcast and she's also a pediatrician. So I asked her about this scenario of Cheryl leaving her pager at home. And I was just kind of making sure, like, that is concerning, right? And she said, absolutely. I mean, that would be abnormal. And she said her pages come through an app on her phone now, whereas Cheryl in 2002 was using a physical pager, but she said if she weren't responding to her pages, that would get her in trouble, right? So this definitely drew concern, the fact that Cheryl left behind her pager and her cell phone. I also asked about Cheryl agreeing to watch her sister's kids when she was on call. I thought that seemed a little odd, but she said as an outpatient pediatrician, it's more flexible and it wouldn't be unheard of to agree to watch your sister's kids while you're on call. So then that also made me think, well, with her pager, how likely was it that she was going to get a page in the middle of the night? I don't know. I'm probably not super likely. So I guess Cheryl could have left knowing that she was leaving her pager and cell phone behind and could have thought, I'm only going to be gone for a few minutes or something and surely everything would be okay. Or she just left in a hurry, not thinking about it. Cheryl wore an insulin pump, but it was reported that some of her diabetic supplies were still inside the home. So again, that this is all just coming together to form a problematic picture. At that point, Cheryl's car was still missing. If they could find her car, the idea was that it could lead to Cheryl or at least point the police in a direction to search and investigate. Cheryl's family scoured the streets of downtown Memphis near the pyramid just in case she went back out that night after her friends left, but they didn't spot her car there. The police were fully involved and had started searching around Cheryl's house. Helicopters and bloodhounds were utilized in the searches as well. 2 days after Cheryl was last seen, searchers recovered her car, a dark blue 2001 Audi, parked at an apartment complex just about a mile north of her home on the opposite side of the golf course she lived across from. Cheryl had no known connection to this apartment complex. Other than that, she lived close to it. According to a 2016 ABC 24 News report, the police said they had searched that area the day before the car was found and didn't see it there. So this raised the possibility that the car had been in another location the day before and moved there. But it's also possible that it was missed in the initial search of that area. When the police spoke with the apartment complex's residents, no one saw a person drop off the car, and without cameras, they had zero clues as to how Cheryl's car got in that parking lot.
So was there anything of note that they were able to find within the car, or were they able to pull fingerprints or any sort of DNA?
So to your first question, what they found in Cheryl's car is kind of interesting. So inside, they found $140 in $20 bills in a bank envelope that was left near the front seat along with her checkbook. The police have said the cash being left behind like that told them robbery was not the motive. Inside her car's trunk, they found her medical bag that contained numerous personal belongings, including her car and work keys. And I think that's one of the strangest details about the car is that her keys, her car keys, were in the trunk of her car. That was an indicator that something was deeply wrong. Why would Cheryl lock her keys in her trunk? Despite that, her car showed no signs of foul play or a struggle. Her car was visibly extremely clean. The word used to describe it was immaculate, too clean. Further, when the car was forensically examined, no fingerprints could be collected, not even Cheryl's. So the circumstances were already suspicious, and this information takes it to another level. This shifted the investigation from a missing persons case to more probable foul play.
Yeah, so the car was purposefully cleaned by someone other than Cheryl, right? Because why would Cheryl completely just wipe down the car for you of any fingerprints or anything?
I can't think of a single reason why she would wipe down her own car like that.
Both inside and out.
Right. For not a single fingerprint to be picked up, not even a partial fingerprint. Someone wanted this car to be immaculate for some reason. And it probably wasn't Cheryl. We'd have to believe that if she cleaned the car, then she did it in that period after she was last seen, because we know she drove her car the night before she disappeared and between when her car was found. So in that period when she was missing, we'd have to believe that she was cleaning her car for some reason. And again, it just doesn't make sense because we know that Cheryl, even if she wanted to leave her life and start anew, she would know that her car would be found and it would be identified as belonging to her, and it should have her fingerprints on it. So someone else was either behind the wheel or in that car. And why clean it unless you are connected to Cheryl's disappearance? After the discovery of the car, they conducted more searches. There was a wooded area nearby, so that was searched, but they found nothing of interest. So there was this big question. What convinced Cheryl to leave her home in the early morning hours of January 5th? Alternatively, could she have been forced out? Well, the police found one possible clue when reviewing her phone records. They didn't seem to glean much from Cheryl's cell phone records, but Cheryl received a call on her home phone at 1:58 a.m. the day of her disappearance. So between 1 and 2 hours after her friends departed her home. The investigators established that the call came from a payphone at a nearby gas station and convenience store. This gas station was only half a mile from Cheryl's home. The majority of statements from the Bartlett police indicate that Cheryl did answer the phone and the call only lasted 5 seconds. There was one interview with the Bartlett police with ABC 24 News where they stated the call lasted 2 minutes. I suspect the person interviewed misspoke because every other statement from the police is that it was a 5 second phone call. Whether it was a 5 second or 2 minute call, that would change the situation entirely because you can't have much of a conversation in 5 seconds. A 5 second call to her home phone seems more like someone wanting to check if Cheryl was home. It was pretty late, so you'd think she would be home, but maybe not. And Cheryl's house had a 2-car garage. So someone just driving by wouldn't necessarily know if her car was home, and therefore she was most likely home. I couldn't help but think that calling her landline and not her cell phone was an intentional decision. And it made it appear that someone who knew her and her phone number called her. Otherwise, someone could have looked up her number in a phone book, I suppose, or this could have been an accidental call, a red herring altogether, although the timing would be extremely coincidental. She gets this phone call from a payphone, so an anonymous phone call, and then she's never seen again.
Yeah, you're not going to be able to get a lot of information through a 5 second phone call. But at the same time, we don't know that it was Cheryl who answered the phone.
That's right? True. I did say they know Cheryl picked up the phone because that's what they said, but we only know that the phone was picked up. The only person who would know with certainty if it was Cheryl who answered the phone would be the person who placed the call.
Right. So this, you know, this could have been pre-planned with multiple people involved. Someone breaks into Cheryl's house and does whatever and waits for a phone call from a second person from the gas station payphone and gives a signal or whatever, like I'm in place or the car's in position, anything like that, just to give this person who got into Cheryl's house a message.
Well, could it also be them checking if that person was done with whatever they did?
Yeah.
So then are you thinking the person got in Cheryl's car with her, forced her in there, harmed her, and then put her body in there, something like that, and then drove off and met up with this other person?
Yeah, I think that's a possibility. Yeah, and again, this is all just based on what a 5 second phone call would entail.
My only problem with that, I think, is that there were no signs of forced entry to Cheryl's home. So we'd have to consider that this person got Cheryl to open the door somehow, which I would be surprised if she opened the door at that hour to someone, unless it was someone she knew, which is very possible, or they broke in a way that didn't leave a trace, or she left a door unlocked. So I guess there is a way they could have gotten in without leaving signs of it. Before I fully researched this case, I knew what happened at a high level, and I thought that call got Cheryl to leave her house. She met up with someone and then something happened from there. However, I just go back to, how do you get someone to leave their house in a matter of 5 seconds? I don't think you easily can. At least I think it would be difficult to get someone to go to a specific location, certainly. If someone close to Cheryl called her in a panic and said, I need your help, and that was it, how would she know where to go? And even in a hurry, you'd think she'd bring her cell phone and pager unless she didn't plan to be gone for long, or it was just so abrupt that she didn't even give those items a thought. If the interview where the police said it was a 2-minute call is correct, then that changes everything. That would be plenty of time for someone known to Cheryl to arrange to meet up with her. But it all seemed to point to the idea that Cheryl knew her assailant. And in an interview with NBC's Dateline, Bartlett Police Inspector Stephen Johnson suggested someone could have said to Cheryl on that call, "I'm on my way over," or "I'm down here at the service station, meet me." But with those statements, it would have to be someone she knew. And of course, there was no surveillance footage from the gas station to identify the caller, nor were there any fingerprints collected from the payphone. And the use of the payphone in itself is interesting. If this is not a red herring, then clearly this person didn't want it to be known that they called Cheryl. Plus, it's just interesting in the sense that payphones were not as popular at that time as they had been in years prior. So this phone call remains a mystery. There was at least one person who stood out to the police during the course of their investigation, and that was Cheryl's brother-in-law, Chuck, the husband of her sister, Lorinda, whose kids she was supposed to watch the day she disappeared. At the time of Cheryl's disappearance, Chuck was out on bond because he was facing aggravated robbery charges of a bank from the year before, for which he was ultimately convicted. This caught their attention because it was someone in Cheryl's life who had a violent criminal offense in their history. This was aggravated robbery, although robbery and potential murder are two completely different crimes. Lorinda was the beneficiary of Cheryl's life insurance policy worth $150,000. It was not paid out when she disappeared, since there was no proof that Cheryl was deceased, but could that have been the motive for Lorinda and her brother-in-law to potentially harm Cheryl? I suppose, but I wondered if they were even aware of the life insurance policy. And wouldn't they have known that if they made Cheryl disappear, Lorinda wouldn't receive the payout for many years? According to the police, Lorinda and Chuck had some marital and financial issues. So I think the interest in Chuck's bank robbery is most likely tied to this life insurance policy. The police interviewed Chuck and Lorinda and asked for alibis from them. Chuck provided an alibi for the night, and I presume Lorinda did as well, although I haven't seen mention of hers. And Detective Ken Lee said they weren't 100% satisfied with his alibi, saying there were some inconsistencies with it. The police even made a couple of trips out of town to places he said he was to attempt to verify his statements.
So Lorinda and Chuck weren't together that previous night.
It sounded like he was in other locations. Yeah, but I don't know. Lorinda's alibi isn't mentioned at all, but I don't think she was considered a person of interest. The focus was more on Chuck. Some of Chuck's statements could be confirmed while others couldn't. And he denies any involvement in Cheryl's disappearance. And Cheryl's parents said they don't believe he was responsible for harming her. The ABC 24 News 2016 report about this case shared that Chuck was cleared as a suspect. Without being able to confirm his alibi 100%, I'm not sure how he could be ruled out unless he was far enough away at certain points when they could confirm his alibi that made it impossible for him to have harmed Cheryl in the time frame in which they think she was harmed. No charges were ever filed against Chuck in relation to Cheryl's disappearance. Kind of seems like they were focusing on him because they had no one else to focus on, because no one else has been brought up in this case as a potential suspect.
I'm curious to know what the dynamic between Chuck and Cheryl was, but I'm sure you would have mentioned that if we knew. So I'm assuming we don't know what it was like, whether they liked each other, whether they got along.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'd be curious to know too, because we're looking at this through the lens of a potential financial motive. Could they have financially gained from Cheryl's disappearance? Yeah, yes.
That would have been a bad plan though.
I know. Yeah. Lorinda could have financially benefited, and you would think therefore Chuck would as well. But I think it's a terrible plan to make Cheryl disappear and you wouldn't have access to that money for 7 years right. when you can finally declare her legally dead. So that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So yeah, we're looking at, or the police were looking at this from a financial motive perspective. I'm sure they looked at it from a personal motive angle as well, but I saw no mention of that. So I don't know what their relationship was like, but not just with Chuck. I mean, was there anyone who could have had reason to harm Cheryl? There was the one mention of Cheryl's boyfriend that I brought up earlier. So I don't know much about him or anything about their relationship, but the police looked into him and they were able to confirm his alibi. So it could have just been that she was seeing someone new and they had to rule this person out. In 2013, an inmate came forward claiming to have second or third hand information about what happened to Cheryl. Apparently, there were women in Georgia who had information about Cheryl's case, but that was just another dead end. The inmates and the women in Georgia, it didn't go anywhere. Cheryl was declared legally dead in 2009, and her family does not believe that she's alive out there somewhere, putting them through this pain. And considering there hasn't been a single trace of her since January 2002, she never practiced medicine again, no sightings of her, nothing after all this time, I think it's a fair presumption. This case is hard to make sense of. I'm really not sure what to think. Other than that, I think Cheryl knew the person who brought harm to her. I have a hard time seeing her leave her home willingly in the early morning hours of the day she disappeared and leaving behind her cell phone and pager. I think it's possible she answered the door to someone and let them in and something happened, kind of like you suggested, or she just left in a hurry. I imagine the police looked into the friends she spent her final hours with, but that's not really been discussed either. One of her friends participated in a media interview, but it didn't seem like she knew anything to aid the investigation. And there's no information that we're aware of to suggest they had a motive to harm her. Now, I did find something else that I've been holding for the end here because I don't think it relates, but when you research this case, you come across a wrongful death lawsuit that was filed in February 2001, and Cheryl is listed as one of the defendants in this case. So there's a facility listed here, Methodist Healthcare Memphis Hospitals, as one of the defendants, and then it lists another individual, and then Cheryl, and then pediatric emergency specialists. So since this was filed in 2001, she would have been going through this at the time of her disappearance. It had not concluded yet. But like I said, I don't think this connects. It's not brought up at all in this case as to how this lawsuit could have anything to do with her disappearance, but it was just something I noticed and felt I should bring it up. Her name is spelled wrong in the document I found. It's spelled with one R instead of two, and her name is spelled with two R's. So For a moment, I wondered if this was actually the correct Cheryl Pearson, but it is based on what I could find.
Yeah, that's definitely an interesting angle on this. I mean, it could have been a disgruntled parent of a patient that Cheryl had that, you know, unfortunately passed away, and they felt she was responsible. Or maybe not even passing away. A kid could have just gotten extremely sick, or any long list of unfortunate circumstances that a child could go through that a parent may see Cheryl as directly responsible for.
Yeah, I mean, it's a terrifying idea, but I suppose it's possible. And finding this did kind of open up the possibility in my mind of just thinking about her work more in general as a pediatrician. Could her line of work have been tied to her disappearance? Possibly. I mean, it sounded like she got along with all of her colleagues, so I'm not sure what the angle would be there, but something along the lines you suggested, I suppose, is possible. But again, it just doesn't seem highly likely. There is a $41,000 reward for information in Cheryl's case, so please contact the Bartlett Police at 901-385-5565 if you have information. Dr. Cheryl Pearson would be 60 years old today if still alive. She is a Black female with dark brown hair and brown eyes. Her height is 5'6" or 5'7" with a weight around 160 pounds. She has a long, dark-colored birthmark on the right side of her face and a small sixth finger on each hand. So two very distinctive features that would make Cheryl stand out. Thank you all so much for listening this week.
And special thanks to Dr. Natalie.
Yes, Natalie's insight was very much appreciated. That is all for this case, but we will be back next week with a new case. Bye.
Bye.